And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, we're ending up our first month. The system seems to be having a problem. But as I was saying, we're ending up our first month in lockdown. And certainly it is interesting to be at home 24/7. And it can wear on your nerves after a while. I do notice a lot of neighbors out walking around. A lot of information has come out about this Wuhan virus. Supposedly, the initial research was done by a Harvard professor of chemistry. He's been arrested, as well as two Chinese nationals. One of them was caught with two vials of it, trying to smuggle them out of the country. Supposedly, it's a recombinant virus. In other words, it's two different viruses mixed together. And one is from bats, and the other was laboratory devised. And if that's the case, we're dealing with nothing more or nothing less than biological warfare, which certainly will have a major impact on society. In looking at the virus, I was given a briefing this morning by the Department of Veterans Affairs. And they're expecting a major surge here between the 22nd and 24th of this month. And if that's the case, that means infection for those people that show symptoms actually starts next week because it's a 7-day lag time. If they can't figure out how to stop it, it could run rampant. I mean, we sit down here on the southern border. There are people ill in Juarez. There are people ill here in Las Cruces in New Mexico, right across the border. In fact, Las Cruces is only 40 miles from here. So we're basically at ground zero of what's expected to be a major hotspot very shortly. And literally, there's no place to go and no way to get there. Now, all that having been said, we've been talking about secret societies. And we've talked about the Masons, and we've talked about the Priory de Sion. And there are those who say that there's a secret society behind what is happening in the world right now. In fact, I've been working on a series of books, they're called The Assassination Files, that deals with the existence that I can prove of an organization started at the end of World War II that was supposed to be created in order to safeguard life as we know it. But in any organization, no matter how good the idea upon which it's based, it gets to the point when those in charge decide what they want is paramount to what the organization wants. So maybe we've got a group that, some of the wealthiest people in this country have long been behind youth. I think it's called eugenics. In other words, limiting the number of people on the planet in order to make climate change less of a problem. We could be looking at that. But right now we're going to talk about the Druids and the Gnostics. You know, it's difficult to imagine two groups whose origins and interests are in sharper contrast with each other than Druids and Gnostics. One was born in Celtic mysticism, the other in Judeo-Christian theology. One's rooted in naturalism, the other in spiritualism. One sought perfection in this world to match the perfection of the next world, and the other saw this world as hopelessly lost and evil. Now, they're united by misunderstanding and oppression, two qualities that drive individuals and organizations alike into secrecy. And they are also shadowy in their origins and activities. And when the shadows are deep enough and the passage of time is long enough, even the most benign groups acquire a veil of suspicion. Especially if they tend to dance in the woods or are viewed as askance by organized religion. Indulging in a little magic, as both Druids and Gnostics tended to do, didn't help their reputation either. But keep this in mind. Even Christianity and Catholicism both began as outlawed cults. Now they're two of the major religions in the world. You know, each year approaching the winter solstice in the Northern Hemisphere, men and women in many Christian nations delight in performing a custom rooted in Druidism. Now, the practice, with its clearly sexual implications, is performed in the presence of a poisonous and parasitic life form, suggesting that the Druids were a society of subversive deviants who conducted pagan rituals within the open-air temples such as Stonehenge. Classic misconception of this shadowy society. The ritual involves couples kissing beneath mistletoe during the Christmas season. Now, this custom has no known connection with Druidism beyond the sacred status according to plant by its members and the oak trees that support it. And there's no confirmed association between the Druids and Stonehenge, except for speculation among some contemporary fringe groups. You know, when I saw Stonehenge, it was certainly awe-inspiring, no question about that. But there was nothing that you could point to and say, Druids. Admittedly, we know little about Druids because they kept no written records. And because they existed less as an organization, more as a position of status among royalty, especially in the Celtic communities of Western Europe. All of our understanding of Druidism is obtained third-hand. Filtered through both time and social bias. Even the ritualistic use of mistletoe is known to us primarily through the writings of the first century Roman Pliny the Elder. According to Pliny and Maxim of Tyre, Druids considered the oak tree a visible representation of the deity, the result of Druids living in intimacy with the natural world. He wrote, "They hold nothing more sacred than the mistletoe and the oak tree on which it grows." Well, Druidism misread the true behavior of mistletoe. The plant's actually a parasite, drawing nourishment from the tree's sap. Druids, whose specialty, after all, was spiritual studies, not botany, believed that mistletoe gave life to the oak. And this idea became strengthened in winter when the oak lost its leaves and grew dormant, but the mistletoe retained its foliage. According to Pliny, anything growing on the oak trees is regarded as life sent from heaven, a sign the tree's been chosen by the gods themselves. When the mistletoe is found, it's gathered with great ceremony on the sixth day of the moon. According to Pliny the Elder, first a feast was held beneath the tree bearing the mistletoe. After the completion of the feast, a druid priest in white vestments climbed the tree carrying a golden sickle, a pruning hook, and gathered the plant in a white cloth. When he came back to the ground with the sacred plant, two white bulls were sacrificed to the gods in exchange for the mistletoe. Now, the Druids, incidentally, weren't the only people to hold mistletoe in such high regards. The Japanese treated it with similar veneration, although they favored a variety that grew on willow trees. The Swiss, the Slavs, and others considered mistletoe an exceptional plant, representing many mystical qualities most associated with fertility. Now, the fertility connection spawned the custom of couples kissing beneath the mistletoe's fruit during the winter solstice in hope of the woman becoming pregnant and bearing a healthy child during the coming year. Now, mistletoe and its winter solstice Christmas ritual remains the only tangible link but most people maintain with Druidism, but the movement is considered by some to comprise a secret society working towards very shadowy ends. Now, Druid refers not to a member of the religious sect, but to the priestly class of Celtic and Gaelic societies, especially in the British Isles. True origin of the word's been lost in the mists of time. Several theories do abound, though, including one that combines the Greek word drus, meaning an oak tree, with the Sanskrit word vid, meaning knowledge. And the Sanskrit word for timber is dru, D-R-U. The Greek word identifying forest gods and tree deities was Dryades, another clue. Celtic scholars categorized Druid as a term for the men of the oak trees, and the Gaelic Drua identifies a wise man or a sorcerer. Other clues point to Teutonic and Welsh origins. Whatever the etymology of the word, tracking its origins leads to an endless and unanswerable chicken or eggs discussion. It's maybe enough to accept the word suggests one meaning above all. Priestly. And while priestly implies the Druids performed a religious function, their role extended well beyond that purpose, encompassing philosophy, science, traditions, teaching, judgments, and fulfilling the duties of a royal counselor. Maybe the best way to describe them in today's vernacular is religious intelligentsia, with the understanding that religious implies a wider meaning than normally ascribed to it. The Celts lived as close to nature as any ancient people, and in fact, closer than most. Their myths and beliefs and practices reflected their deep woodland environment, a world that simultaneously supported, frightened, and eventually spiritually uplifted them. And those seeking to become druids at the height of the movement's influence, generally considered to be between 100 BC and AD 1000, qualified according to three levels of ability. The initial level of ovates consisted of neophytes needing no special purification or preparation. Dressed in green, they were welcomed into the order according to their naturally acquired knowledge of medicine, astronomy, poetry, and music. Ovates wishing to advance in recognition and power studied to become bards. Excuse me. To qualify to be a bard, they were assigned to memorize at least some portion of a reported 20,000 verses of druidic poetry. And they were often portrayed strumming a primitive harp, holding as many strings as there are ribs on the human body. The strings comprised of human hair. Candidates to become bards wore striped robes of blue, green, and white, the three colors identified with the druids. And when they had achieved a full status, they changed to a sky blue garment. Well, the third level marked the highest rank. The Druidan, distinguished by white robes, symbolizing purity. Druids ministered to the religious needs of their people. Within this group were six ascending levels or degrees of wisdom and power, each degree marked by a different color of sash worn over the white robe. In the uppermost position were archdruids, elected by their peers according to their virtue and integrity. Now, there were never more than two archdruids at any one time. The men identified by golden scepters carried in their hands and wreaths of oak leaves crowning their heads. Now, the training period required for an individual to qualify as a full druid was apparently extensive, some historians claiming it took 20 years to absorb and understand all the teachings. And such a level of acquired wisdom qualified druids for special privileges, and during royal festivities, a druid always sat to the immediate right of the king, filling the role of the king's conscience. As one prominent Celtic historian put it, the druids counsels and the king acts. Maybe the best modern analogy is of a corporate CEO and its legal advisor. The CEO may deliver bad news to the shareholders, but the phraseology originated with the lawyer. Incidentally, studies suggested many druids were women, fully in keeping with the dominant culture of the time. Celtic women enjoyed more freedom than other females of their time, including the right to join in battle and fight to divorce their husbands. In Ireland and Scotland, at least, it's realistic to believe they played a substantial role in the practice of druidism. And extending that earlier analogy, it's highly likely the Celtic world experienced more female druid priests than our current world contains female CEOs. It wouldn't be hard. Male druids lived in strict abstinence and celibacy, dedicating their lives to the study of nature, the accumulation of wisdom, the assessment of nominees to the order, and maintenance of the order's secrets. Many found that a life of solitude best suited their philosophical needs, and while some resided in monastery-like residences, most lived in rough-hewn shacks deep in the forest, entering villages and towns only to perform their religious duties. Even during the Dark Ages, that was considered somewhat eccentric behavior, and unusual qualities began to be attributed to druids. They became associated with magic and divine events, including an ability to defend their land from invaders by causing great clouds of fog and mist to appear on command. They also represented the earliest form of peace activism. The Greek historian Diodorus, who considered druids as intermediaries between man and gods, described the practice of druids throwing themselves between threatening armies as a means of avoiding war. For centuries, druidism was the dominant influence on spiritual belief in Europe, and until diluted and pushed westward by the arrival of the Roman Empire, followed by the spreading influence of Christianity. In fact, this paralleled the decline of Celtic influence generally. From the dominant social structure of pre-Roman Europe, the Celts gave way first to the Romans and later to the Saxons, reduced to pockets in Wales and Scotland. Only in Ireland did the Celts retain their identity through centuries. Caesar, as talented at observing and recording social structures he was at commanding armies, found druids especially interesting. He noted that the Gaelic and Celtic societies maintained three levels of class. Plebeians, who were little more than slaves, equites, the nobility, and druids, who provided guidance on holy matters and wisdom. He wrote that a great number of young people searched them out for instruction, and the druids are treated with much respect and veneration. It's they who judge all public and personal disputes. When a crime is committed or a murder takes place, and when an inheritance or land boundaries are contested, the druids determine who's at fault and who's been harmed, and decide the damages and penalties. And all druids are under the command of a single druid who exercises the ultimate authority on them. Caesar also noted, considering his reputation and primary occupation, druids didn't go to war. In fact, they were exempt from military service of any kind, and they didn't pay taxes. They were remarkably forgiving in a supple society who welcomed into their ranks anybody who successfully pursued a defined course of study focused on the natural world, the manner in which it represented the deity. This openness towards new members seeking leadership may not appear impressive given our familiarity with contemporary organized religion, but the prospect of gaining access to a privileged class solely on the basis of education and vocation was almost revolutionary. The practice of accepting all who qualified by dint of study and dedication influenced Christianity. Instead of demanding its leaders be selected according to bloodline or some mysterious deity-operated lottery, as previous religions had, Christians agreed with druidic tenets that anybody who absorbed sufficient knowledge and demonstrated high levels of commitment could fulfill the role, whatever their social origins may have been. Now, this was new and frankly beneficial. It also followed a Christian tradition, or you might say strategy, of adapting characteristics of the pagan model it sought to displace. And it worked. From about AD 500 forward, druids and Christians were riding opposite ends of the same teeter-totter. The higher Christianity rose in power, the lower the druids sank. So you have to ask yourself, who was most responsible for the decline of the druids, the Romans or the Christians? And it depends on where you stand, literally and figuratively. In continental Europe, where Roman influence was paramount, the Gauls adapted Roman law and customs as a prudent means of self-preservation. Now, if you remember, the Gauls actually became the French. Under Roman law, Druidism became so compromised that it essentially ceased to exist until resurrected later in a highly modified state as part of Christianity's operative machinery with Druid high priest, replaced by bishops and abbots. In the British Isles, the impact of Romanization proved not nearly as dominant. In fact, Druidism managed to survive the onslaught, finally yielding to the Saxons. Ireland avoided invasion by both Romans and Saxons. As a result, much of our knowledge of Druidism retains a decidedly Irish flavor. With this awareness in mind, Druidism may well have been broader in scope, more complex in structure than we could ever know. After the Irish Celts adopted Christianity and became among its most fervent missionaries, Druidism fought a nearly hopeless rearguard battle. Prominent Druids withdrew to remote regions where they secretly spread their doctrine and oral traditions to the few stubborn adherents that sought them out. As time passed, though, the power and the influence of druids dwindled until they were viewed by common folks as little more than fortune tellers and prophets. Descendants of the apocryphal Merlin and his ilk, cursing and conjuring, but achieving little beyond a measure of entertainment. You know, with so little recorded history and such limited achievement, why did druids occupy any position at all among our grasp of secret societies? Well, the answer lies within the movement's romantic association with installations such as Stonehenge and the assumption that druidism accomplished long-forgotten mystical practices and secret occult knowledge. There is, after all, nothing like the sin of lost knowledge to boost a society's status in the world. The idea that the druids knew something the rest of us didn't grew out of an 18th century fascination in England and Scotland mysticism, often embraced in a playful manner to relieve the tedious restrictions of Calvinism, Lutheranism, and other movements that assumed that anything fun was a sin or should be. During this period, Freemasonry crystallized as a secret fraternal society, adapting as it did certain elements of the public's erroneous perception of druid mystical practices. The Masonic use of exotic headgear, among other rites and costumes, was derived from druidism in various ancient cultures. There's more mysticism than fact in the common association of the druids with Stonehenge. The druids may have conducted some sort of ceremony at Stonehenge from time to time, but they were people of the forest. They didn't prance and dance on the windswept Salisbury Plains. Besides, historians have pegged the date of the site's origin around 2000 BC, long before any indication of the druids' existence. Now, Stonehenge may have actually functioned as a temple or an observatory or a monument or any of a dozen other things, but we don't know for certain what it was, but we do know it surely wasn't built by the druids. Irish culture assimilated many druidic beliefs and values, and their echoes and influences can be found in the poems of William Butler Yeats and the novels and short stories of James Joyce. Several mystical elements of druidism may indeed represent the stylistic core that distinguishes Irish authors and mark the reason for their unique impact on English literature. You know, the demise of the sweet-natured druids at the hands of the Romans and the Saxons, Philistine in comparison they might be, may also represent the wishful root of Celtic literature. Yeats made use of it several times in his poetry, including lines from To the Rose Upon the Root of Time that sum up all the gentle Celtic sadness as effectively as a group singing choruses of Danny Boy. You know, the druids appear several times in Joyce's Ulysses, although with less reverence and more boisterousness than Yeats' melancholy references. When Stephen Dedalus tells Buck Mulligan he'd just been paid, Mulligan rejoices, four shining sovereigns. We'll have a glorious drunk to astonish the druidy druids. Well, these and other references to druids in Irish literature and folklore help fuel speculation that druidic influence extends down through the ages, even to this day. Like the Masons encouraging the concept of a link with the Templars, many of those who claim a connection with druidic belief encourage the idea that the ancient movement continues to operate in secrecy, with a vague aura of conspiratorial activities. And their efforts serve to promote a patina of mystique to a faction that is more influence than substance, been composed of more fable than fact. Well, leaving the druids for a moment to appreciate the breadth of Gnosticism, imagine a private club whose rules and activities are equally attractive to both Hugh Hefner and Mother Teresa. Now, if you can grasp the concept of such an organization, you begin to understand the deeper teachings and contradictions of ancient Gnostics, if not their contemporary supporters. The name derives from the Greek word gnosis, meaning knowledge. The G is silent. It's G-N-O-S-I-S. In this concept, the definition is inadequate. It might better mean insight or enlightenment. Might be more accurate to say that. Knowledge suggests a factual, intellectual aspect rejected by adherents of Gnosticism, who believe our true spiritual nature can be found only by looking within ourselves. Both our bodies and the material world in which we live are evil because they were created by the malicious God of the Old Testament. And now another reason that the Gnostics were so abhorred organized religion is the religious leaders couldn't control them. And if they couldn't control them, they couldn't get tithes from them. And if they couldn't get tithes from them, what good were they? You know, even though everyone wants to ignore it today, at the basis of the most organized religions is we'll tell you about God and you pay us. You know, our pure inner spirits, in contrast to the product of a higher, more abstract God, is revealed by Christ. So the goal of Gnosticism can be described as a means of freeing our pure spirits from the enclosures of our evil bodies. And beyond this central core of their conviction, little about the Gnostics can be easily established, including their origins. Some sources claim they predate Christ. Some claim they were contemporary with the first Christians, and some identify Gnosticism as a reaction against many of Christianity's firmly established tenets. A number of clues and a handful of facts exist to define the group's belief, structure, and influence over the past 2,000 years. Gnostics, like followers of all religions, believe the world is imperfect. Gnostics go further by insisting it's evil. Like Buddhism, Gnosticism acknowledges that that life is filled with suffering. In fact, suffering is inescapable. All life on earth survives by consuming other life, and mankind consumes more than its share. Beyond its basic needs for survival, mankind inflicts multiple layers of suffering on a grand scale via wars and on an individual scale through insults and betrayals. Along with suffering some injury and death as a result of natural catastrophes like earthquakes, floods, fires, drought, pestilence, and disease. But the human spirit, according to Gnostic teachings, is pure. Only the matter that surrounds it, including the body it occupies, is flawed. By that measure, life is absurd, and only by fleeing this imperfect world can spirit and truth prevail. The concept of pure spirits residing within an evil world represents an about-face from traditional Christian principles, especially as articulated in Genesis. The Old Testament's initial tale describes a perfect paradise in which two near-perfect people dwell in bliss until the arrival of the serpent persuades them to contaminate it and themselves with sin. Gnostics would argue the world is already evil before the arrival of the serpent. And of course, that concept doesn't endear him to the Christians. This core concept of an evil world launched a remarkable schism in Gnostic beliefs and practices, producing extremes of both ascetic and licentious sects, leading to that opening analogy of Hugh Hefner and Mother Teresa under the same philosophical umbrella. But what is amazing is that there's a rationale for both points of view. Ascetic Gnostics, which include followers of Saturninism and Manichaeans, consider the human body as evil matter and tried to divorce themselves, or more correctly, their pure spirits, from such actions as much as possible. Separating soul from body, in their view, is the first stage in elevating the spirit to ultimate salvation. They believe matter, as exemplified by the body, was sinful, and distancing itself from all matter strengthened and purified their spirit. As a result, these Gnostics avoided food that provided anything beyond mere sustenance. Marriage was sanctioned because it united two pure spirits, but intercourse was forbidden, a decision that no doubt produced much frustration and, frankly, no offspring, since children are considered merely the reproduction of yet more evil matter. But this led to an interesting question. If there were no children to be brought up in the beliefs of the parents, how would the organization continue? This same philosophical foundation pointed licentious Gnostics such as Ophites and Carpocranians to in the opposite direction. If pure spirits or souls are alien to this evil world, then it didn't matter what they did here on earth. To these Gnostics, the concepts of sin and immorality were rarely addressed. By definition, everything the soul did was pure and everything the body did was evil. And since both were separate entities, Why worry about the ramifications? Well, this led to a few startling tales of Gnostic activities, many of them challenging credulity, and some reminiscent of the scandalous lies spread by early Christians. And in the case of the Gnostics, the Christians themselves may have been the instigators of the licentious rumors instead of the recipients. Promiscuous intercourse was attributed to this group of Gnostics who, having sanctified each other and been redeemed, were now above the law. They were taught all the earth is earth, and it matters not where one sows as long as one sows. About 2,000 years later, this was paraphrased into, if it feels good, do it. The Ophites, a group of Gnostics whose name honored serpents, based their entire communion service on the presence and activities of a snake. Service began by attracting the reptile from the safety of its system mystica and encouraging it to slither among loaves of bread, which were later eaten. Members were required to kiss the snake, which was either very tame or well drugged on the mouth, before falling to their knees and worshiping the animal. Now, I came from a part of the country where taking up the snake actually meant a religious action. I was invited by a young lady I was somewhat enamored with to go with her to church. And I did. And everything looked normal. Until the preacher reached down into a basket and came up with one of the biggest snakes I'd ever seen in my life. Well, I couldn't see a polite way to get to the door. And they started into the service, and he's waving that snake around, and he said, now, I know we got some guests here, and they get to hold the snake first. Well, I was trying to make myself as small as I could so I couldn't be seen, and when the young lady I was with waved her arm in the air and said, he's a guest. Well, the preacher brought me the snake, and handed it to me. Well, actually, he handed me his arms over which there was a white cloth. And since it was done behind the pulpit, I didn't see which way the snake went. So I really wasn't sure what was going on, but, you know, I was there. So he said, put your hands under the cloth. And I did. And as soon as I touched that snake, I knew where the snake went. And he whipped away the cloth, and I had the snake held in both hands. Now, the snake and I looked at each other. Neither one of us were very happy about where we were at or what we were doing. And after I stood there for a minute, not knowing what the procedure was, I said, well, I see there's only a few snakes, and there's a whole lot of people. So let me pass this sucker on. And I turned and handed it to the young lady who had gotten me into this. And as she was dealing with the snake, I slowly made my way to the back door. And got past the guards, and yes, they had guards at the door. And I'm out in the parking lot getting my pulse back to normal when services end, and she came out and wanted to know why I'd left. And I said, well, I was so overcome with emotion that, you know, having held the snake, I just had to come out here for air. And she thought that meant I was very religious. My belief at that moment in time is I needed to get as far away from that whack job as I could. Taking up the snake is not something I think is very exciting. I've dealt with snakes more than once in my life. I shared one with in a sleeping bag during a major storm. We were both constrained to reach a level of truce due to the inclement weather. But as soon as the storm abated, me and a snake each went in a different direction. Yeah, it, followers of Gnosticism, led by the Carpocrats, were granted even more license and encouragement than were the other two. Carpocratians believed the purity of the soul couldn't be contaminated and made evil any more than a pearl could be debased by dropping it into mud. At its center, the pearl always remained a pearl. based on his libertine view, the soul ought to be experience everything available to it in this world. So they shared their sexual partners, took part in massive orgies, although the males were instructed to practice coitus interruptus, not as a method of birth control, but as a means of collecting semen to be consumed as the body of Christ, the same as menstrual blood was. Recruitment methods of the Capricornians were basic and no doubt successful in attracting male followers. The most beautiful female members were encouraged to offer themselves as bait, so to speak, to draw adherents, and a related group formed a male elite called the Levites who practiced open homosexuality. Should a woman become pregnant as a result of these activities, the fetus would be aborted, pounded to jelly in a mortar and mixed with honey and spices and eaten by sect members. A practice chilling and reminiscent of the most lurid fables associated with early Christians. And I might also point out, associated with the Templars. Now, this kind of practice represented an extreme, maybe even mad branch of the Gnostic belief. Large and more respectable was the group led by Simon Magus, a charismatic scholar who fills an interesting role in at least one biblical tale that provided an eponymous definition in English. Born in a Sumerian town of Gida, Magus was raised in Alexandria, the great intellectual center of the civilized world in its time, where he first received a first-rate Greek education and was baptized by Philip. Reportedly, acquired enough skill in Arabic Jewish magical medicine to make himself invisible, levitate himself at will, and metamorphose into an animal, or at least persuade his audience he did. A follower of John the Baptist, Simon gathered his own disciplines around him and was viewed, not surprisingly, as a potential competitor to early Christian leaders. He appears in the New Testament, in the book of Acts, chapter 8, verses 9 through 24, in a less than favorable light when he encounters the apostles Peter and John and attempts to purchase spiritual powers from them, which provided the source of our word simony, the practice of trafficking in spiritual powers or items. Now, Peter responded, "Your money's going to perish with you because you thought that gifts of God may be purchased with money. You have neither part nor lot in this matter, for your heart's not right in the sight of God." And that may have motivated Simon to launch Gnosticism, as some followers claim. If he didn't actually institute the religion, he's acknowledged as the inspiration for a faction whose members were labeled, not surprisingly, Simonians. Simon's view, shared by most Gnostics, the true God possessed a female aspect, a mother god sometimes referred to as Sophia, in recognition of her wisdom. This attitude angered early Christians, but it wasn't quite as revolutionary as it appears today. The Hebrew version of the Old Testament actually identifies the Spirit of God as Ruach, feminine gender. Now, Simon would have been aware of this reference and perhaps used it as a stepping stone toward new interpretations of the nature of God. As often occurs when freethinkers challenge a dominant authority, it wasn't what Simon proposed as much as the way he proposed it. He later personified his vision of God's femininity in Helen, a woman from Tyre who some Christians claimed was a prostitute and others described as a shameless slut, lured by Simon away from the bed of Dositheos, Simon's former mentor. Whatever carnal attraction Helen may have represented to Simon, she apparently inspired him to a somewhat higher level because he claimed to see the Spirit of God in her. And while this supported many Gnostic beliefs, including the idea the Spirit of God existed in all matters, Simon's claim that it took a fallen woman to reveal a deity to him really outraged Christians. Now, Christians may have become his enemies, but Simon had friends as well. One of them was the Roman Emperor Nero, who appointed him court magician and was amused by Simon's skill at causing furniture to move without it being touched and walking through a wall of fire to emerge unscathed on the other side. Now, Simon's magical skill, according to legend, did have its limits, and he met his end in one of two ways, depending on the source. One account claims Simon boasted he'd be buried alive as Christ had been, and after 3 days he'd rise from the grave hale and hearty. Well, the burial took place, but the resurrection didn't go as planned. In the other account, Simon Bragg had risen to heaven from the forum with the apostles Peter and Paul observing the event as witnesses. Employing his levitation skills, he began to soar into the sky. When Peter and Paul fell to their knees, praying fervently for Simon to fall, well, apparently their prayers were answered, and Simon dropped to the forum, dashed to the pieces near the Via Sacra. Adherents to this version delights in visiting the church of Santa Francisca Romana, the Roman Forum, where the stone in which Peter and Paul knelt to play remains on display. The mark of their knees pressed into the marble surface. You know, the death of Simon Magus and other Gnostic sect leaders produced neither the collapse of the religion nor its elevation as occurred with Christianity. The Gnostic core belief continued to evolve, spurred on by new leaders, and while the creed didn't want for a constant renewal over several centuries, the result was an often bewildering range of variations when it came to values and practices. In fact, along with the concept of a true, ultimate, and transcendent God in a faulty world in which humans dwell, the only constant factor among Gnostic sects was the notion of aeons, intermediate beings filling the void between humans and God. Aeons and God comprised the realm of Paloma, or fullness, because they enjoyed the same potency of divinity. Simon Magus's Helen, renamed Sophia in honor of her wisdom, was an aeon in Gnostic teachings. Humans, as long as the spirit remains trapped within its flawed evil body, are merely existential according to Gnostics. Instead of the fullness we're promised, we live in emptiness. The spirit's most valuable ingredient is the divine spark, the element that separates us from other forms of life and remains trapped within the prison of the body. Unless the required degree of gnosis is gathered during life, the spark will be re-embodied upon death in another flawed, evil form of earthly life. Sort of a, if you can't get it right, keep doing it, philosophy. Not every human is capable of achieving the goal of retaining the spiritual element beyond earthly existence. Those whose spirituality is strong enough to make the transformation are called pneumatics. They'll achieve gnosis and liberation. A second group, identified as psychics, have little awareness of the spiritual world beyond matter and mind, and they may, through sufficient efforts and insight, rise to the level of pneumatics. Most people labor in heletics are earthbound and materialistic. Their dedication to physical reality and their inability to achieve gnosis dooms them to forever remain in a flawed evil existence, which gives a lot of support to the concept of reincarnation. As Christianity grew in strength, it became less tolerant of Gnosticism. In the Christian view, Gnostics were basically Christians who'd wandered so far from the path their beliefs became heretical. And whether or not Gnostics suffered abuse at the hands of Christians, their numbers shrank and they began to exhibit classic behavior associated with secret societies, including the use of initiations, passwords, secret handshakes, and communications via codes and symbols. By the end of the 3rd century AD, Gnosticism ceased to be an influential movement, although segments of its central teachings could be found among the dualist religion Manichaeism. Well, as medieval religions grouped like the Albigensians, the Bogomils, and the Paulicians, students of the Kabbalah perceive kernels of Gnosticism within that philosophy, and small non-Christian sect, the Mandaeans, reported exist in some corners of Iraq and Iran. Otherwise, for almost 1,700 years, Gnosticism has become something of a shadowy footnote to the rise and domination of Christianity in the Western world. Its near anonymity, broken only by efforts of people such as Jacob Boehm, who revived the movement, and echoes of its philosophy in the writings of William Blake. Gnosticism received two injections of renewed interest during the 20th century. The first occurred in 1945 near the Egyptian village of Nag Hammadi, when 12 codices containing over 50 writings on Gnosticism were discovered by a peasant digging an irrigation ditch. Their origins trace back to the 4th century. Likely prepared by monks at the nearby monastery of St. Petronius and hidden to escape destruction by the emerging Orthodox Church, the scriptures provided a wealth of information on Gnostic teaching and values. Meanwhile, psychologist Carl Jung was evaluating Gnosticism as a source of inspiration for his groundbreaking experiments and writings on the workings of the mind. On that subject, he found traditional Christianity lacking in insight compared with Gnosticism. In the ancient world, he wrote, the Gnostics, whose arguments can be very influenced by psychic experiments, tackled the problem of evil on a broader basis than the church elders. And these events, plus the drug-induced frenzy to explore mystical practices and belief that swept North America during the 60s, restored another wave of interest in Gnosticism. For the most part, however, the Gnostics represent bit players in an ecclesiastical drama extending over 2,000 years. Their secrecy more a means of protection from attacks from Christians than a means of carrying out acts against society. There have been many, many stories regarding the Gnostics. In fact, there was one crusade that was directed towards southern France, the Languedoc area, and basically the implied order of the Pope was to destroy the Gnostics, who had sinned against the word of the Pope. Well, the next organization that we might find of interest is the Kabbalah. Now, there's a story. A man in search of universal truth travels to Israel, where he studies an ancient school of mysticism based on the same Hebrew text from which the Bible evolved. According to this wisdom of the ages from an elderly Jewish scholar, the man achieves a degree of enlightenment he hadn't been able to attain through some other systems of belief. With each revelation of this ancient knowledge, he felt his soul elevated, his powers expanded, his insight honed, and his horizons broadened. But when his mentor died, the man vowed to carry his acquired wisdom to a select group of people who are prepared to engage in the sacrifices necessary to absorb the knowledge and benefit from the teachings. He planned to spread his message to the ends of the earth, providing humanity with secrets hidden for several millennia. He's going to convey this power as a means of alerting humanity to its destiny. And he became the new source for the ancient wisdom known to one and all as the Kabbalah. Now, it's not a religion or an organization. It's actually a system of thought drawn from Jewish theosophy, philosophy, science, and mysticism. With various interpretations and spelling of the word, they all relate to the notions of a secret oral tradition handed down through generations to a select few students by scholars and wise men. The exclusivity of knowledge and closed structure Kabbalah gives rise to the English word cabal, meaning a private intrigue or of a sinister nature. And over time, this definition reversed its flow to the point where these traits are now applied to the root word regardless of its original intent. Kabbalah, many believe, functions according to the definition of cabal, suggesting a group of Semitic conspirators working in the shadows to achieve devious ends through secretive means. Now, it began as an oral tradition. An interpretation of the Word of God is expressed in the first five chapters of the Old Testament, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. In the Torah, also known as the five books of Moses, these books represent a general philosophical basis for Kabbalah, including historical descriptions of the origin of Judaism and over 600 specific laws. Those familiar with the Old Testament chapters will recognize that laws are almost non-existent in them, with the exception of Deuteronomy. And other books, especially Genesis and Numbers, consist primarily of stories and analogies as a means of presenting ideas that can be translated into laws. And where laws were concerned, ancient Hebrew theology was divided into three sections. First was general biblical law taught to all children of Israel. Next was Mishnah, the soul of the law granted to rabbis and teachers. And finally came the soul of the law, the Kabbalah, concealed from all but the most perceptive and worthy Jews. Beyond this definition, things become confusing to the uninitiated. On the one hand, followers of Kabbalah and Jews generally believe that every word and every letter of every word in the Torah conveys special significance, requiring wisdom and insight to decode its true meaning. On the other hand, stories in the Torah don't follow strict chronological order. The location of one story versus the other may have more to do with the concept of the belief structure than its relationship to tales preceding and following it. With such an enormous range of interpretations, it's not surprising that various factions have seized on their own explanations of messages supposedly hidden within the Torah. One faction even suggests the entire content of the Torah represents the true name of God broken into stories in order that mortals lacking divine discernment can absorb it. See, that's one of the main functions of a secret society. I know something you don't. And unless you get to be at my level, which can only happen with my cooperation, you'll never know what I know. It's a challenging, confusing, and inhibiting task, this attempt at knowing the unknowable. In one sense, Kabbalah represents a technique of bypassing logic to fathom these meanings with a transformation of consciousness. Other disciplines that employ similar techniques to achieve similar results include Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, Zen, and some forms of yoga. Originally, extensive training was required to elevate the searcher's consciousness to the necessary level, a process involving a sequence of experiences and even more radical and demanding in its methods. With time, Kabbalah became a label encompassing the entire range of Jewish philosophy, designed to probe the mysteries of life and death by discovering the essence of God. As evidence, Kabbalah scholars point to elements in this search in the Bible, including portions from the opening chapter of the book of Ezekiel. The heavens opened, and I saw visions of God. I looked, and lo, a stormy wind came sweeping out of the north, a huge cloud and flashing fire surrounded by a radiance, and in the center of the fire, a gleam of ember. With the mystical study, the Creator may have been important, but in the opinion of many rabbis, it was also dangerous. According to a well-known Talmudic story, four rabbis once gathered to immerse themselves in mystical studies, vowing to remain in deep contemplation of the Torah's meaning till they reached an understanding. Over time, one went mad, one died a premature death, a third became a heretic, abandoning the faith of his fathers. Only the fourth entered the discussion in peace and left it in peace. This tale and stories of others who became mentally unbalanced while engaged in deep contemplation of Kabbalah teachings served for centuries as a warning that these deep mystical secrets aren't something to be trifled with. Whatever the true meaning of the Torah, Kabbalists generally agree it's best viewed as a practical tool, not an intellectual exercise. And like all tools, it should be applied with the constructive purpose of enlightening humanity and not practiced in solitude with the selfish goal of enriching the reader materially and intellectually. Ultimately, Kabbalah shares similar goals with traditional religions, especially with Gnostics. Both seek answers to vexing questions. Why did a good and merciful God introduce evil into the world he created? How could an infinite God create a finite world? And how is it possible for humans to know the unknowable? Well, Kabbalah deals with the mystery in two ways. One logical, the other allegorical. The logical explanation states that every idea contains its own contradiction. And since the God is the sum of all ideas, he contains all contradictions. Good and evil, justice and injustice, mercy and cruelty, limits and infinity, and other opposites are all united into a greater whole that is God. Well, the allegorical version suggests God as a mirror that shines a bright light towards the world. Before the light reaches us, it's directed through a series of several mirrors. Each time his light's reflected toward us, it loses brilliance until by the time it reaches Earth, much of the brilliance has been absorbed and the pure light is blemished. Among the blemishes are elements of evil and pain, and humans must either see beyond these blemishes or move closer to the source of light and its original holy brilliance. If followers of Kabbalah merely sought knowledge of questions that have vexed every culture through the ages, why were they considered secretive and sinister? And how effective is the movement in dealing with these mysteries today? To simplify an understanding of Kabbalah and its followers, the movement can be divided into three eras or phases: ancient, medieval, and modern. Each is distinctive from the other to the point where the differences are more prevalent than the similarities. Depending on the shade of your religious belief, Kabbalah reaches back to the desecration of Eden when angels who required the knowledge of Kabbalah directly from God brought its lessons to Adam in a way to help him and Eve return to the embrace of the Creator. Subscribers to this tale believe the same knowledge was passed to Noah and Abraham, and finally Moses, who included the first four books of the Bible into Kabbalistic teachings. In addition to these biblical writings, three other books dominate ancient Kabbalah philosophy: the Book of Creation, the Book of Splendor, and the Book of Revelation. Some followers of Kabbalah claim Abraham authored the Book of Creation, although modern scholars date its writing from about AD 12. The Book of Splendor originated about AD 160, authored by Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, who sentenced to death by the co-regent of the Roman Emperor Aurelius Antonius, hid in a cave for 12 years while he wrote the text. And the author of the Apocalypse may or may not have been St. John the Divine, and its role within both Kabbalah and Christian society continues to be controversial. A few scholars call it outright pagan writing born from the scheming mind of someone steeped in Egyptian and Greek mysticism, and composed as a counterattack on the efforts of Christians to convert pagans. According to this theory, Apocalypse was meant to serve as a means of converting Christians back to pagans. In a corollary to this idea, popular in the early part of the 20th century, the pagans may well have been Jews seeking to satirize Christianity for their own amusement and ends. But whatever the origins and intent, the scenes of death, destruction, and selective salvation in Apocalypse are difficult to for modern readers to comprehend, especially identities linked to its many allegories. To readers more than 1,500 years ago, for example, the allegory of the great whore that appears in Apocalypse refers to Babylon. The beast with seven heads that she rode would be understood to represent Rome and its seven hills. Ignoring these coded interpretations, contemporary readers, especially those in fundamentalist evangelistic branches of the faith, appear to delight in the visions of Apocalypse, discovering prophecies and foreseeing myths of the two millennia of Hebrew scholars appear to have overlooked. Well, you can argue about religion all day long. And if you study it in the various books, you can get 50 different interpretations. Maybe one day we'll know the truth. Well, I hope you all are doing well. I hope you're enjoying your lockdown, I guess is one way to phrase it. And we'll be back tomorrow night to talk more about secret societies and some of the mysteries of the world. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for The Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.